You are listening to The Pulse, Rod Murray's e-learning tech podcast, number 129.
Hi, this is Rod Murray. Welcome back to my podcast. That was a teaser from A Passage of Life by Kitaro. He's one of my favorite New Age music composers. I hope you enjoy it, so stay tuned for the full piece at the end of my podcast. This podcast is sponsored by Inside Higher Ed, the online source for news, opinion, and jobs for all of higher education. I also invite you to follow me on Twitter. My handle is RodsPods. As always, I post links to all of the things we talk about on my show notes at www.rodspulsepodcast.com. Today, I had the pleasure of talking to Brian Alexander, educator, futurist, speaker, writer, and senior researcher for the New Media Consortium. It's interesting. I know he looked familiar, and I had met him someplace before, and finally occurred to me. He was a speaker in a workshop dealing with the New Media Consortium's annual Horizon Report, which if you haven't seen, I certainly recommend you take a look at. Anyway, today we discuss the future of higher education. He certainly has a lot of insight and experience in dealing with these issues. We talked about some of the educational context, change in international education, the demographics, enrollment decline, and so on, about the technology impact on education, Internet of Things, 3D printing, social media, and so on, and some of the important education issues of our time. I think, for example, that we test too much, the move towards competency-based advancement, e-portfolios. Interestingly, he calls the LMS learning management system the dark web. He also talks about the adjunctification of higher ed and some of the impacts of that on certainly the employment of faculty and what they should be doing to keep themselves employable and fresh in this new world. So I invite you to listen to the interview with Brian Alexander. So without further ado, here we go.
Well, Brian, I'm really happy to have some time to talk to you. You've come to me recommended. I think one of my colleagues heard you speak, and I began to look at your website and so on. So for those of my audience that don't know much about you, can you give me just a brief history about who you are and what you do?
Sure. I am currently a researcher, consultant, speaker, and writer. My focus is on the future of higher education, particularly under the impact of new digital technologies. In the past, I have worked with a nonprofit that worked with small liberal arts colleges in the United States, and I helped them grapple with emerging technologies. And before that, I was an English professor. And before that, I worked at a used bookshop. So I've got a kind of diverse mix, more or less centered on education.
So, I was looking at your publication. You do Future Trends in Technology and Education, and looking at one of the more recent issues, and you talk about education and sort of the global context and technology, and then education technology. What would you say are some of the drivers of the changing educational scene?
Well, there are a bunch, and I can break them up into different categories. One is technology, and some of the impacts of technology are very interesting. A lot of the technology drivers are now pretty widely discussed, but it's important to keep them uppermost in mind. And one is the increasing diversity of devices that we are migrating more and more to mobile and personal computing. So it's not uncommon to see students on campus with, say, two devices, a laptop and a phone. Perhaps they have a game player like a PlayStation or an Xbox. Perhaps they have some kind of a Fitbit, a health device that's monitoring them. They may then also have access to other devices on campus, laptops, printers, and all relying on a wireless network powered by routers. That's a pretty conservative depiction of where we are now. That's a richer, broader, much more complicated technology world than we had just 10 years ago. And all the indications point to us doing more and more of this. We keep generating new categories of devices. I mean, the personal fitness device is pretty new, for example. We're seeing virtual reality make a comeback with head-mounted displays, which can be as complicated and well done as the Rift, or as simple as a 3D printed holder for your cell phone, which you can strap in front of your eyes and get a low-rent version. We're generating more and more inputs, and this has already begun to change education in all kinds of ways. I mean, one is that we get more access to the panoply of education. That is, if you're walking across a city, or if you're walking across a quad, or you're riding in the subway, you have more access to educational materials, both formal from your class and informal from the whole world. You have more access to learners, you have more access to teachers, and you have a greater set of platforms by which you can then push out your responses, be they comments or video or remix. So, I mean, that's really our multiple access points of technology have really been burgeoning. The second is that we digitize more and more stuff. We've been doing this since the 70s, but it's important to know that we just continually migrate more and more content into the digital world. This is not a shock for some people, say under 18, but it's already transforming the lives of many, many adults. A third piece of this is our digital experience outside of campus really exceeds what campuses have to offer. You think about web design, for example, what you can get off of a site like Medium or Facebook, and then compare that to the experience of Blackboard or Moodle. You know, those lag behind by a decade. Moreover, you think about the customization and personalization that we're accustomed to in the technology world. Think about the Amazon recommendation system or Netflix's use of data to fine-tune your experience. I mean, these kinds of things are largely missing from the educational experience. We see the socialization. I mean, social media is obviously enormous right now. I mean, it's really transformed all kinds of things, from politics to shopping to news to personal relationships. And it really is only still marginal in an education. I mean, a lot of our course management systems are basically asocial, if not antisocial. They provide little parts of the dark web away from the open web. So they break links going in, for example. But also we know from social media that people love sharing. They love connecting with people. We know a lot about their behaviors, and that doesn't really impinge directly on campuses. I mean, there are exceptions. One exception is faculty, some, a minority, who use social media for research, for professional development, and sometimes for courseware. We also know that almost everybody on campus informally engages in social media, and so there's a kind of secondary aura of technology around campus. So this has changed student life. This has changed the way we do professional development. In fact, social media has already had impacts on certain academic fields. Economics, for example, is roiled with debates, partly driven by what occurs in the economic blogosphere. You know, one set of drivers that's already mutating and changing campuses in a revolutionary way, we have the rise of alternatives to education, formal education. You know, we have the possibility of using online academies to have an entirely separate form of education. That's something that we're still looking to see where that would go. I mean, that's all one category. And there's other pieces of technology, but it's really beginning to roil our pot. The other side is the non-technological drivers. For example, where are you based right now, Rob?
In Philadelphia.
Okay, so one of the things that we see is the demographic transformation of the United States. So in Pennsylvania, your K-12 population is shrinking, right?
I believe it is, yeah.
I mean, that's true in the majority of American states, which is a kind of mind-blowing thing. We really haven't experienced this for more than a century.
That's right. I think it's the baby boom reflection that I think my daughter was born in 92. She was at the peak of the baby boom reflection, and now that's going down.
Yeah, the echo boom, yeah. Well, I mean, if it used to be, I don't know if you saw this in the Future Trends report, that if you do a demographic visualization of a population by age, and you can do it in a series of horizontal layers like a cake. And the bottom layer is the youngest, say children, infants. The next layer is the next oldest and so on. And the very top layer would be your oldest population. And usually that result looks like a pyramid because the greatest number of people you have are the youngest and they get reduced by age over time. Well, instead of a pyramid, the United States now looks like a rectangle. We're looking at having as many seniors as we do teenagers. You know, we're looking at having more seniors than we have minors, kids under 13. this has all kinds of impact on everything in America, from how we are rethinking pensions and Medicare, Medicaid, to how we think of a popular culture. I mean, for example, we've seen some huge businesses that have in public said that they are shifting their marketing away from teenagers and towards seniors, because the senior market is simply more lucrative. I mean, so there's all kinds of interesting changes. But for education, their impacts are very, very deep. One is that the K through 12 population has been shrinking. I mean, there are exceptions. Arizona, for example, Texas. But generally speaking, I mean, even California has seen that population shrink. And that has a lot of impact on how we finance K through 12, the pedagogy of K through 12. And then that starts to hit higher education, because the traditional age undergraduate schools are now beginning to see this, and they're beginning to compete for a smaller population. And that's very hard, given that the finances of higher education are in such disarray. So you're seeing competition for a shrinking pool begin to heat up. And that's already caused a lot of schools to start seeking students abroad, especially in East Asia. So already the demographic change has begun to transform the population of undergraduate education and to transform that very experience.
Yeah, I also would assume that there's an increase in, you know, non-traditional students. And a lot of these retirees, I think, or some of them are going back to school because they you know, maybe they're not working, but they want to keep learning.
You'd think. The median age of students, it varies depending on which report you look at, but it's roughly 29. I mean, the traditional age undergraduate experience is now a niche. And, you know, it's interesting when we talk about higher education in the United States, we're really suffering from a lot of nostalgia. You know, we talk a lot about schools and we often imagine something like Harvard or Stanford or a small liberal arts college. And those are really outliers. And we have roughly 4,600 institutions of higher education in the United States. Adult learning is absolutely huge. Professional training is absolutely huge. So it's important to think about that. But what you said is absolutely correct. And people are not taking that up yet. I mean, the senior market for higher education should be vast. Rollins College, a little liberal arts college down in Florida, as an experiment, did this project. I can't think of the name of it. I'm going to get the name wrong, but it was basically a first-year experience for retirees. So they would pay for the normal freight, the normal year of the Rollins experience, and they would get four classes. And it was a hit. I mean, and I talked to some of these retirees who were taking the class. They would say things like, yeah, I always wanted to spend time with the great books, but I didn't have time in my life. I didn't have the framework. Or I wanted to learn about science, or I wanted to learn about, you know, history. And now I have the chance. I think it's possible we'll see that. It's just most colleges and universities haven't really hit on this yet. They're very focused on the international student market for now.
That's right. What's your opinion about how the departments of education many of them, are way behind the times. Do you see changes, any changes, a positive direction coming from the U.S. Department of Education?
Now, are you referring to education departments within campuses, or referring to government agencies?
Government agencies, you know, the regulators. Yeah. And
Regulatory bodies right now are in a very, very different space. They're very focused on data and on regulation. I'm sorry, I don't mean to be redundant and say that regulatory bodies are focused on regulation. I mean, they're unusually so. And this is, they're still in the age of No Child Left Behind. And this is a fascinating moment, but they're really focused on measuring student performance, measuring student outcomes, and trying to shape that and then respond to it. Just a couple of days ago, New York State's Governor Cuomo issued this blistering attack on public schools. I mean, it was ferocious. At one point, he said, if parents actually knew what was going on in schools, they would dismantle City Hall. You know, they'd be so furious. This is a Democrat in a very, very blue state. The substance of the charge was that some percentage of New York State students were in failing schools. Now, I don't know what they call failing schools. There are a lot of ways you can measure that. But he said that was an outrage and they shouldn't be exposed to that. That's interesting. And that's often where state governments and the federal government are really focused. They're trying very hard to adjust that, prevent it, mitigate it. And it's an enormous, challenging, time-consuming problem because on the one hand, the politics of it are very difficult. You know, there are powerful teachers' unions. You also have very large bureaucracies, both within the schools and outside of the schools. Plus, you also have the real intellectual labor of trying to figure out how to measure learning, where schools have generated their own system for that. States and the feds are not satisfied, and they're trying really hard to figure out how to do this. And they created, you know, the whole series of tests along with No Child Left Behind. They, not the feds, but private agencies created the Common Core along with its associated tests. And that's really where these guys are focused.
Do you think we're measuring too much? I was reading an article today. It was a professor who was saying that he was flipping his classroom, and traditionally he would give them quizzes every session to measure what they were learning on, supposed to be learning on their own, you know, out of class. And he just, and they were, and the, you know, of course the students don't like it, and he stopped doing it, and he claims that he saw an improvement in the performance and the engagement of the students when they didn't have to take quizzes every darn time.
As a teacher, it revolts me. I mean, the sheer amount of testing is just crazy at this point. And what's interesting about that is that it puts us in line with most of the rest of the world. If you look at the enormous swath of British-influenced education, so you know, you think about a lot of East Asia, including China, you think about former British colonies, you know, South Africa, you think about Britain, a lot of these guys really rely heavily on tests. And that even shows up in Harry Potter, right? You have, where the OWLs are the linchpin of the experience. And this really hasn't been part of the American experience. So we're really, in a sense, we're aligning more closely with the international norm. In American culture, we don't normally talk about the rest of the world if we can help it. And in education, we really, really don't want to know about any other country if we can help it.
It's pretty sad when you see the us being compared to other countries and how far behind we are, especially in like science education. It's kind of pathetic.
Well, it is, and there's a lot of argument about that. And one of the interesting things is that the United States experience is so diverse. Some countries have a very central organization of their education system. Some have a mixed centralized and decentralized. We have an extremely decentralized education system, and it means that the differences between states are enormous. The differences within states are enormous. So if you look at one of the big tests, the OECD's PISA test, you'll see the U.S., actually, we haven't really dropped. We've stayed the same, more or less, for a few decades, but other countries have caught up. They've what some people call the rise of the rest. The other thing is, if you break down U.S. data by state, you know, you can see huge differences. The biggest difference, I think, was between Massachusetts and Mississippi, which is kind of like the difference between France and North Korea. I mean, it was just a huge, huge gap. You could see similar gaps within individual states. I mean, the state where I live is extremely odd. We passed a law about 20 years ago that mandated no differences in funding across school districts. And it was controversial then. It's still disliked now. I think it led to a migration of a lot of people to private schools, but it's really had some beneficial effects. But outside of our tiny state of Vermont, you'll see many, many states have this kind of diversity. So that just adds to the complexity of our great age of measuring. You know, you asked the question about how departments of education are doing. You can see why this is so time-consuming and so resource-consuming of their work. And they're not done yet. They're still trying to figure out regulatory responses to schools that don't do well in the testing regime. And the White House is still producing their rating system for higher education, which, you know, in a sense, has never really been done. They're trying to do something new and a bit shocking. So, I mean, that's where they are. And there's all kinds of reasons to keep doing this. I mean, part of it is bureaucratic and governmental inertia. Another is we haven't really been good about collecting data on these kinds of things. And a big debate to have now is whether or not America as a whole really values teacher and school autonomy. Do we really think that these professionals should be deciding their curriculum and their pedagogy and their assessment regimes? I don't know to what extent we believe that anymore.
What's your take on the trend of going more for, instead of the credit hours and the time in the seat, so to speak, in moving towards outcomes-based learning?
Yeah, it's a serious trend. It may be one that we embrace and that changes education in America forever, because the Carnegie unit of butts in seat time, right? That's one that was always a stopgap and didn't really measure anything. So now we're at the point where we can actually, you know, measure, let's say, learning. And we can shift on the one hand to competency-based education. And we've been doing that for a while. I mean, everything from kids coming to university for the first time, being able to take tests so they can, you know, advance more rapidly in areas like foreign languages, for example, or math. When I was 18, I went to the University of Michigan. They had a writing assessment where students were given the chance to write an essay, and the faculty would assess those essays, and based on the essays, they would drop you in whatever writing class was most appropriate. I actually hated that so much, I wrote a satire in response to the question, and they tried to put me in remedial writing. One more point about assessment, I don't want to lose sight of this. It runs into other issues as well. One is that it tends to shift towards the quantitative, and for some people that can mean that for qualitative departments, that can be a real challenge. But another thing to think about is this has led to a great expansion of power and influence on the part of a lot of companies that provide testing materials and curriculum. And so that's really beginning to change us. We're talking about competency-based learning. This has a few other advantages. One is for adult learners, it makes it easier for them to return to college or go to college for the first time. It gives them a leg up. It recognizes their life of experience, which is a very good thing. But the other is that we have a serious problem with completion, both completing a degree at all as well as completing it in time. What some people call the completion agenda. And there are groups like the Lumina Foundation that are single-mindedly focused on this. If we can do more competency-based learning, that can speed people's time to degree. That's a big win. But on the other side, we have alternative assessments. I mean, badges are out there. Badges are being used in the wild. They had support from several federal agencies. And I don't see a lot of them being used in higher education right now, but I see them being used online. And it may be that's another way to build an assessment. There's a third. See, this is a problem. You say on the one hand, on the other hand, you'll inevitably run into a third hand. On the third hand, there's been the steady, really uncelebrated growth of e-portfolios. So this gives us, you know, the advantage of saying, okay, here's Rod. He went to school in this one school, and all I know is his GPA. And maybe I can look at his transcript, and that's kind of it. But if Rod can show me his e-portfolio, I can dive into his work. I can see what his lab reports look like. I can look at one of his English papers. I can really get a more nuanced sense of who this guy is, his strengths, his weaknesses, his character. And, you know, e-portfolios just continue every year to grow further and further. The technologies are robust, well understood. There's all kinds of pedagogies being built around them. I mean, a very exciting theme now is integrating more storytelling into e-portfolios. That's a heavy duty and I think very effective way of changing assessment.
What place do you think the learning management system has in all of this? You know, we're a Blackboard school, and we all would agree that Blackboard was a little slow to change. I think they're actually ramping up pretty well from what I've seen, what's coming down the pike. What's your feel for the necessity of an LMS? I know there are faculty that go out there and just use other resources that are free and on the web and so forth. Do you see a future for the LMS?
You know, I didn't used to. And I think there are two powerful forces that may keep the LMS going. As far as I can tell, one of the most powerful uses of the LMS is copyright enforcement. You know, it lets faculty and staff defend themselves against lawsuits and takedown notices very efficiently, because it gives you a nice automated system for e-reserves that lets you basically build in compliance to the Teach Act. And that's, for as flawed as the Teach Act is, that is for education our main shield for digital rights and for digital copyright. So I think that is still there. And as long as we still have the copyright nightmare that we do now, I mean, the situation in copyright is really a disaster. And as long as we have that, I think that's going to be a major issue. And the second is plain inertia. You know, we have many IT shops that are deeply wedded to Blackboard or Moodle or Sakai or whatever. I mean, I tease Blackboard a lot, in part because under its previous administration, it was a pretty bad corporate citizen. I had a lot of criticisms. I've published on this, but now under the new CEO, is it named Bott, I think?
That's right, Jay Bott. I interviewed him on one of my last podcasts.
That was a really good discussion. I really appreciated that. I'm not just saying that to be nice because I'm on your show, but I really, I mean, you were very patient and really pulled out a lot from him. But I think the faculty can also be wedded to that. It's very difficult to say to a faculty, we need you to completely change your workflow for a learning management system to something else. And so I think that's going to, you know, we may have a generation of LMSs, and they'll look more like Canvas or the new version of Blackboard than they will, say, the older versions of Moodle. But I think those two forces are pretty powerful. Now, while that happens, you get people who go around the sides of this. You get professors like Mike Wesch, for example, or Gardner Campbell, who will set up their own materials for different reasons, because they find the LMS pedagogically restrictive or because they want to be public.
Right. I mean, they want to have open education. Yes.
And that's when, I mean, if you're building a class in Blackboard or if you're building a class in Sakai, you can link out to other things, but nobody can see the inside of that. It's a black box. I mean, a friend of mine used to run a wonderful resource, the Resource Center for Cyberculture Studies. Terrific, terrific place. Interdisciplinary research into online life. And he found, I'm going to fudge the date a bit, the number of classes that he could link to grew through the 1990s until around 2000, and they started going down. And he was worried. He said, did the field of cyberculture just begin to go down? No, it wasn't that at all. It was that up until that point, faculty would put classes on the web just using whatever web publishing tool they could. But after that point, they were in Blackboard or in LMS, and they basically went dark. And so there's this dark web of material that no one could access. So you have faculty who want to go around that, but also faculty who see that the students increasingly live in a very, very different environment. They may live in social media. They may simply be accustomed to searching and putting stuff up on the social web. And so they want to honor that. Moreover, increasingly, you know, faculty come up that way. Talking about faculty who are in their 30s, if they are lucky enough to have that rarity of rarities to be in a tenure track job, this just may be part of their experience. If they're not tenured, if they're adjunct, then putting stuff in the open web is actually more efficient, because if they're working 3, 4, 5, 6 campuses in one semester, it really helps to have everything on one blog, for example.
Right, right.
Where they keep swapping out materials back and forth.
So speaking of adjuncts, what's your take on the growth of online education?
Clayton Christensen was predicting that the crossover would happen in 2016 or 2017. And that may well happen. I think the traditional age undergraduate experience, 18 to 22 years old, I think that will largely remain residential and face-to-face, in part because of developmental issues and in part because of parental issues. You know, parents want to get kids out of the house. But above that age, I think you'll find wholly online or largely online will become more and more normative. I was at a meeting with a group of faculty and senior administrators in New York State, and we were out for dinner, and we were talking about this, and one person said, well, I think a really major driver is simply convenience, that online learning is a lot more convenient to use and access than face-to-face. And another person, who I think was a dean, said, I don't think so. I think you're really overstating that. The waitress then turned to us and said, no, actually, convenience makes a big difference. We said, what are you talking about? She said, well, she said she wanted to go to college when she was, I think she said 22 or 23. And she had a kid, very young child, and she also had a job. And she found it extraordinarily difficult to juggle all the balls, to get the schedule set up, you know, to be able to make it to classes, handle childcare, arrange shifts at work and all this. And it didn't work out. A couple of years later, online learning became accessible, and that just made it all work for her. I just love this anecdote because, you know, the people around the table were just staring open mouth, like, what? And she said, do you mind me saying this? And I'm like, no, please say more. You know, I hope we didn't ruin her her job that night. But I think the convenience factor just counts enormously. And it also involves a couple other things. I mean, one is the technology is simply getting better and better. I mean, more and more online learning that uses video or audio like we're doing now. And also the technology is becoming more and more accessible to a broader and broader audience. The second thing is a kind of social transformation where we become more accustomed to this. And this is a gradual iterative process. But I remember in the 90s when we were talking about online learning, distance education, there was often the objection, well, you know, online learning can't replicate the immediacy and intimacy of a classroom. I always hated this comparison because you think, in part, Well, I've had some classrooms that were intimate that I didn't want to be intimate, but more to the point, you could think of classrooms that were awful, that were cold, that were unsupportive, that were ill-organized and all of this thing. And it was unfair to compare an idealized version of the very best of face-to-face learning with a kind of ordinary median online learning. I think people have gotten past that. I mean, we live so much of our lives online now that we're really accustomed, and we recognize that it's pretty good. I mean, we have people who meet each other, fall in love, and get married based on online experiences. That's normative now. We have gaming, which is so, so enormous. We're asking about trends. I mean, one of them is gaming is the world's second biggest culture industry. I mean, what a transformative force. And we know that social gaming is, in many ways, the way that we often prefer to game. Not all the time, but often. And so we're really accustomed to just thinking and living online. I think at some point we will see a 50-50 split. And then it falls back to the face-to-face classes where they have to really make the most of what they've got. Rod, are you a movie person? Do you like going to theaters?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Me too. When I was going to college in Ann Arbor, I mean, I was just in heaven, you know. I've never lived in a place as rich for that experience. Well, one of the things that happened is starting in the 80s with the rise of a videotape, but then really taking off with DVDs and now streaming media, you've had so many opportunities to watch movies that don't involve going to movie theaters that movie theaters had to respond in order to capture people. And so that's why we had stadium-style seating. That's why we've had 3D and then, you know, ever more elaborate food.
Food, I know. We have two theaters in the area that, you know, you can eat your dinner while you're watching the movie.
Are they Alamo?
To be honest, I don't recall. I've never been to one, but I've heard about them. But
you really should. They're a lot of fun, and you know, they're trying to compete with what you can do at home. So I think in many ways, face-to-face teaching will have to do something similar, and we already do in many ways. You know, we have ever more luxurious. Well, maybe it's not the right word, but ever more elaborate and higher quality dormitories and cafeterias and wellness centers and climbing walls and all of that. Almost nobody in the world does this. This is an American specialty.
Yeah. Right? Now, who's that? Is that for the parents or the students?
It's both for the parents and for the students. It becomes a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy because one of the ways this plays out is people thinking, well, if I'm spending $5,000, $10,000, $20,000, $50,000 a year, I want the experience to look like it, right? And in part, this is a historical relic. This is the inheritance of the 1990s and the first decade of the 21st century, where we had a different kind of economy, one what seemed to be a lot more growth, which seemed to be a lot richer. We now know that it was actually partly built on smoke and mirrors, and we also know that it was a very unequal one. But that was the ethos, and so we still have some of that inherited. But then it feeds itself because the campus, in order to pay for all of this, has to increase tuition. So, you know, it goes back and forth. But the other thing is you have to think about new forms of pedagogy, often enabled by technology. So are we talking about campuses that have maker spaces? Are we talking about campuses that have, say, blended learning, you know, greater roles for digital technology in face-to-face learning? So that could be everything from using social media and video in the classroom to producing digital content in the class. You know, that's going to be a race, in a sense, where face-to-face education is going to have to really fight hard to compete. So if you're going to physically go to a campus, you're going to want to expect that.
I guess it's going to be an evolution. You know, when I look back at my education, which was mostly lecture-based and therefore teacher-based, a lot of faculty, especially, you know, the older ones, like to hear themselves talk, and they get up there, and there isn't much warmth or interaction. And so I hate to say it, but maybe some of this is really only going to move forward when we see some of the older faculty. And I count myself up there with them retiring.
Oh, I agree. In academia, I mean, we have a couple of generations of faculty and administrators, who are mostly faculty, who came of age in a certain time, and that's where their habits were formed, and that's where their practices were formed. That's where they were rewarded, and often where they love to work and how they love to work. And if they don't want to change, they have very, very few incentives to actually change right now. And they can basically stay in place. And ever since we removed the mandatory retirement age of 65 back in the 1990s, these guys can stay on for longer and longer. And eventually they will leave. But in the meantime, they become department chairs, they become division chairs, provosts, VPs of economic affairs. That's a heavy hand on development. I know every campus that I've worked with, the provost position actually became critical. If the provost wanted to use technology, people cut loose. If the provost was against it, it advanced at a snail's pace. So it may be that we're simply watching, you know, the passage of time that will enable things to shift.
I was wondering if you have any parting words for new faculty and where they should be putting their time and effort.
Well, poor guys. Because, you know, we made this historical shift and it was largely unremarked and still not fully appreciated outside of academia. But we shifted so that the majority of American faculty, the majority of teaching, the majority of classes are taught by adjuncts. And this was done with open eyes. And we did it to ourselves. This wasn't forced upon us. This is something that higher education did deliberately, largely through the voice of faculty, either faculty as administrators or through faculty governance. And it's a terrible shame. And for a lot of young faculty, my heart goes out to you guys. I'm a big supporter of adjunct unionization. I think that's one way forward. But the damnable economics of it is trying to boost the number of tenure-track jobs, trying to boost compensation for adjuncts, runs smack into the problem that we have of tuition being high, debt being high, and no one wanting either to go higher still. So that's a terrible struggle. So if you're a young faculty member who is part-time, who's an adjunct, I'd recommend first working with union movements to get something going, and second, to put as much as you can online. Because that is, in many ways, the best way to do professional development, the best way to get feedback, the best way to make contacts. I would also recommend trying out technologies, only try one or two at a time, and get really used to them. So if you teach in a face-to-face environment, figure out clickers, personal response systems. You know, get used to using YouTube and video. Pick digital audio, which is, you know, in many ways, my preference. Use social media. If you teach online, push for where the cutting edge is. Talk to people like the Alexandra Pickett at the SUNY system, who are just living at the cutting edge of what you can do with online learning, and really focus there. Skate way ahead of the puck, as they used to say. The other is embrace the open. This is one of the great struggles of our time, is the struggle between open and its enemies. And put as much out there on the web. Use Creative Commons licensing. Value it. Use it in your own work. If you make a slideshow, grab as many CC licensed materials as you can. That's a great fight to fight. I mean, there are a lot of people who are behind this, a lot of foundations who are behind it. That's a glorious struggle to be part of.
Well, I think, you know, that's great advice, actually, not just for education, for just about any profession these days, you know, keeping up your network and being out there socially and having a presence. And
absolutely.
I think this is a great discussion. I wish we had more time. You're certainly an eloquent speaker, and I really appreciate the time you spent with me here today.
Rodney, this is my pleasure. The time just flew by, and I look forward to hearing more thoughts and to talk with you down the road.
So that's it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed the interview with Brian Alexander. Don't forget to take a look at my show notes at www.rodspulsepodcast.com. for some links to some of the things we talk about. So stay tuned for the full song, A Passage of Life by Guitaro. Until next time, have a great week.
that's it for today's episode. Thank you very much for listening. Don't forget to give Rod feedback. You can leave comments on his blog, send email to rod@rodspulsepodcast.com, or leave audio feedback on his comment line at 610-616-2199. The preceding audio commentary is the product of the author, Dr. Rodney Murray, and does not represent the official viewpoint of the University of the Sciences or any other institution or company.